So as Inez was saying this morning, the great thing about a meditation retreat is this opportunity for continuity of practice, that we get a much larger period of time in which to practice being present, being aware, being in contact with our experience. And I like to think of, you know, the entire meditation retreat as having this sort of ongoing posture of alert, attentiveness, wakefulness, investigative, steadying. And it's just the frame that changes. So we go from the practicing that in sitting, practicing that in walking, practicing that while we're preparing and eating a meal, whatever mode we're operating in, we bring that way of being to it. And now we're moving into the frame of Dharma talk meditation. And I think it's really helpful to think of this period as any other period of meditation and cultivation. So that might mean some sense of staying connected with your body and your breath as you're listening. Might mean something like listening with the body, listening with that sense of embodiment, listening with the heart, moving out of a sort of conceptual mode of listening into a more heartfelt mode of listening. And there's no need to take notes unless that really helps you. You can just listen and trust that whatever's important and timely will stick. And also know that the talks are being recorded, so you can always go back and listen to them again. So the Buddha counseled this path activity of wise, shift back to gallery view, of wise effort, part of the Eightfold Path of awakening, of liberation, freedom. I learned it a slightly different way. I have a different acronym. This is very similar, but I learned it as PACE, P-A-C-E, pace your effort. So the P stands for presenting unwholesome states that have not arisen. The A is abandoning unwholesome states that have arisen. C is cultivating wholesome states that have not yet arisen. And E is extending those wholesome states. Most of my meditation study and training has been, you know, in the Vipassana tradition. Most of my practice done at Spirit Rock Meditation Center. And it's always been sort of like oriented around a spirit of resting with what is, being at ease in this moment, however things are, really learning to investigate the experience without trying to change it or manipulate it in any way. So when hindrances arise, my training was to, you know, be with the hindrance, allow it to be there, feel the unpleasantness of it as it manifests in the mind and the body, to be with it without judgment, to notice where there's clinging. And the development of this capacity is tremendous. Sometimes I think that's kind of the almost the superpower that comes with our practice, is that we can cultivate being at ease however things are, even when conditions are difficult, to have some sense of being okay even when things aren't okay. I think if you look around the world, it's very easy to reasonably conclude that there's a lot that's not okay. And yet it's still possible to experience joy, ease, well-being, and happiness that's not so dependent on those outer circumstances, because we've transformed our relationship with our experience. I had the good fortune to attend a short meditation retreat with Venerable Bhikkhu Nalio. He's a pretty famous monk and scholar of the early Buddhist teachings. And he gives this meditation instruction, and I'll sort of mimic it. And this is pretty much the pace of the instruction. He's German born, so he does it with a little accent, but I won't do the accent. Feel the body resting on the earth. Feel the body from within the body. Remove the hindrances. Feel the joy of an unhindered mind. And this retreat was to a group of Spirit Rock teachers. I was a trainee at the time. And one of the very senior teachers in our tradition asked this question, you talk about removing the hindrances, like you just snap a finger and the hindrances are gone. How do you do that? And he said, I thought this was an advanced group. Like his approach to the practice of meditation was so different than mine. It was really a kind of empowerment to develop a powerful meditative skill to help you along the path. There's so much more clear seeing and insight that can happen when we're not hindered. So I think I'm kind of going through a little bit of an evolution. I'm so inspired by that, that one could have a meditative cultivation that would be like a recipe for happiness. And this is really what this teaching of the four wise efforts is. And I think there's probably a middle way of how to approach this. You can, a balance point, maybe you find your own balance point, and maybe that balance point changes from time to time. If you're a fixer and your first tendency is to apply some strategy, then maybe you relax the effort and spend more time in the being with, the investigating, the like coming up close to the experience. And maybe if you spent a lot of time doing that, and I think that, like I said, I think that practice is very important and very helpful. But if you've spent time doing that, then maybe moving more in the direction of, how can I have agency over my mind state? So I just want to unpack some of the language that we've already begun to use. Skillful, wholesome, kusala in Pali. These are states of mind that are that lead to the alleviation of suffering for ourselves and others. Unwholesome, unskillful, akusala tends to lead to suffering in ourselves and others. And we tend to know these states when we manage to see them. The unwholesome states can often lead to agitation, confusion, not seeing things clearly, often predominantly unpleasant or unpleasant in the end. They can sap our energy. Wholesome states tend to be more calming, more uplifting, leading to more discernment and wisdom, predominantly pleasant maybe, give us energy and enthusiasm, often lead to the arising of kindness and compassion, which is also very pleasant. So lots of examples of these. I'll just share some of them with you. The greed, hatred, and delusion said to be the root of suffering. Unwholesome, unskillful, kusala. And, for those of you that are new to this, I think most of you are experienced practitioners, but the first time I heard these words, greed, hatred, and delusion, I thought, I don't have those things. I'm not greedy. I don't have hate. And so you can take those as shorthand for a wide range of experiences, from being, slightly irritated to enraged, to the desire for enormous amounts of material wealth, to the desire for a cookie in this next moment. It can be a whole range of experiences. And I think it's quite interesting that in the Pali language, oftentimes the opposite is just a negation. So the opposite of hatred is not necessarily love. We might say the opposite of hatred is love, but the terms that are often used in the suttas are non-hate. So non-hate, non-greed, non-delusion are skillful, wholesome. And I find this helpful. because there are certain political figures, public personas, where it's very difficult for me to get to love. But it might be attainable to get to non-hate. So killing, stealing, false or harsh speech, gossiping speech, covetousness, misusing our sexuality, taking intoxicants, all unwholesome. We brought this in at the beginning of the retreat, you know, partly to create a container of safety, but also because this practice is stepping into the wholesome. Abstaining from all these things, unwholesome, abstaining from killing, stealing, unwise speech. And, you know, I'm going to talk predominantly today about preventing, although there's definitely some overlap in all the elements of preventing, abandoning, cultivating, and extending. But maybe this is our first item on the list of preventing, to follow the precepts, to practice good moral conduct, to live in integrity. And when we practice this, this harmlessness, it's so skillful. We give others the gift of safety, the gift of fearlessness. Where, you know, this feeling of when you're around a safe person, you actually can kind of relax. And so when we practice harmlessness, we kind of automatically reduce the suffering of others in this way. We also reduce our own suffering. When we do things that are not in alignment with our core values, the body will usually tell us. The more and more we practice mindfulness of the body, the more and more sensitivity we develop to listen deeply to the things they're always providing, it becomes uncomfortable when we're not in integrity. And when we're in alignment with our deepest values, it actually feels really good and freeing. When I was a young child, I went to India with my parents, and, you know, I was born here and grew up here. So I had a lot of trouble with the food and all the activities that we were involved in, which is mostly visiting relatives and friends, involved food. And everywhere you'd go, they'd want to feed you. And I was a skinny kid who was very picky. And mostly I wouldn't like the food, but you couldn't really refuse. And you couldn't get away with just like moving your food around the plate. So I came up with the brilliant idea that I would just tell anything I didn't like, I would just tell the hostess that I was allergic to that food. So I developed this long list of foods that I was allergic to. But I was fickle, so the list kept changing. And what I didn't count on is that all the friends and relatives and family talked to each other. So I got caught up in this terrible mess of web of deceit. And what I remember most profoundly about that was that it was very stressful. I was a 5-year-old, and I was really quite tormented by these lies, which really were, you know, like not wanting to hurt people's feelings, but still very unpleasant. Maybe you have this experience of you contemplate doing something unethical and your conscience talks you out of it. And the Buddha called these forces the guardians of the world, that they guard us against unwholesome intentions and acts. When we have real remorse and a kind of conscience, someone wrote a letter to the IRS. It said, Dear IRS, I have been unable to sleep knowing that I have cheated on my income taxes. I've understated my taxable income and I've enclosed a check for $5,000. Sincerely, taxpayer. And it says, P.S. If I still can't sleep, I'll send the rest. But when we act in alignment with our deepest values, we can live in what the Buddha described, the bliss of blamelessness. It's like a remarkable feeling to be able to go through the world unafraid, held up high, that you know that you're not to blame for anything. Other wholesome states worth mentioning, any of the Brahma Viharas, so metta, kindness, friendliness, karuna, compassion, mudita, when we have joy at the joy of others, or upekkha, equanimity, generosity, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, resolve. So you might recognize those from the list of the 10 paramis, all wholesome. Faith. I've been thinking a lot about faith lately. Sometimes when I get too involved in the state of the world, doubt arises. I'm thinking about faith as a kind of antidote to doubt. Wholesome state. And samvega, the Buddha called spiritual urgency, where we kind of feel like, okay, it's all on the line now. We got it now or never. Can bring us energy and enthusiasm to our practice. Sometimes we see the unwholesome as the opposite. So we notice impatience or stinginess or indulgence, lack of resolve. And, you know, we live in such a culture of self-improvement that I always feel like I want to address that there's a way that it can sometimes feel a little bit violent almost, that we discount who we are in favor of who we want to become. And for me, this is kind of a red flag in my practice when the desire to prevent and abandon and cultivate and keep turn into like a lot of negative self-dialogue or have, that has ill will in it. For me, this negative self-talk often reveals itself with the word should. I should blank, fill in the blank, the thousand things I should be or should do or should not do. And sometimes it feels like that voice is encouraging or helping you, but you know, when there's ill will in it, I think it falls in the category of unwholesome. So I want to share a quote from Jim Sinclair. He's a prominent activist for the autism community. And I don't really have, it's not anything to do with autism. It's just he's the one that happens to say these inspiring words. And they're strong and they're nuanced, but they really have helped me. So I want to share them with you. He says, when my parents say, I wish my child did not have autism, what they're really saying is, I wish the child I have did not exist and then had a different non-autistic child instead. This is what we hear when you mourn over our existence. This is what we hear when you pray for a cure, that your fondest wish for us is that someday we will cease to be and strangers you can love will move in behind our faces. Every time I hear that, it's like a kick in the gut, because I've seen some version of that in my own mind, something that's trying to negate and replace. So worth keeping in mind to you know, notice when that self-talk becomes filled with ill will, and that it's then one of the things that we can learn to prevent and abandon. Another way to prevent the unwholesome from arising is by cultivating samadhi, sometimes called concentration, not my favorite translation. When the mind is gathered, calm, collected, unified, the mind is more responsive, more malleable. And we've already begun to do this. This is a natural byproduct of meditation practice, especially on retreat. And we aim the attention at the object of our meditation, the breath, the body. We sustain that attention. And with the right balance of effort, the mind naturally gets gathered and concentrated. Built into that experience often is a pleasant feeling in the body. It can be pleasant mental factors that are energizing and give you enthusiasm. sometimes when those factors are strong, it can feel like there's a kind of effortlessness. The way it's been described to me is it's not so much that I'm practicing Dharma or I'm practicing meditation, but that I'm being practiced in some way. Another way we can prevent the unwholesome is through wise view. One of the, there's a sutta in which the Buddha urges his disciples to frequently recollect these five things. This is done as in monasteries around the world as a daily practice to reflect on these five recollections. I am of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And then it takes a slight turn. I am the owner of my karma, heir of my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma. Whatever karma I shall do for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. There's a modern version of this. There's an app. When you leave the retreat, you can get this app for your phone if you're inspired. It's called We Croak, and it sends you reminders five times a day of, it basically says, don't forget, you're going to die, or remember, you're going to die. And their tagline is, death makes you happy. And I have actually found this to be true. When I'm involved in some internal drama, I'm annoyed at my coworkers, or I have some resistance to something that I know is actually good for me, then this pops up, you know, on my watch or my phone, you're going to die. And it really, it kind of puts things in perspective. Is this thing that I'm so worked up about something I'm going to remember on the night of my death? With wise view comes the acknowledgement that being a human being comes with some measure of suffering. It's the seminal teaching of the Buddha and the First Noble Truth. And as Inez was saying, we don't always get what we want. We often get what we don't want. Sometimes we get what we want and it's not what we thought it would be. It's like you meet someone and you're sure you were lovers in a distant past life, or soulmates. And after 2 weeks with them, you realize why you haven't kept in touch for the last 2,000 years. Al Cleven. There is suffering. It's a declaration of insight, but it's also practice instruction from the Buddha, the practice to know our suffering deeply and intimately. And in some way, when you recognize suffering as suffering, the way in which you're practicing, you're on the path to awakening. And I used to have this kind of belief that whenever I was in some intense suffering, that somehow it was my fault, that I had made some mistake, that there was some user error in executing the program. And this would lead to all kinds of internal, afflictive, self-blaming kind of states. But when I'm able to relax into the truth of this teaching, you know, the truth of suffering, the truth that things are always changing, a lot of this negative self-talk and self-loathing began to fall away. And also, my suffering has begun to seem less personal. Some of this happens with age, and we lean on the elder side in this retreat. So eventually you realize, you know, whatever you've gone through, whatever you're going through, millions, maybe billions of people have had or will have this experience. Of course, the details are all different, but it's the nature of this existence. So when we don't take it so personally, that's freeing. It's a poem I like. It's called The Dakini Speaks. And Dakini is defined as a, quote, female being of generally volatile temperament who acts as a muse for spiritual practice. I love that. I seem to have a lot of those people in my life, so I love that definition. She says, "My friends, let's grow up. Let's stop pretending we don't know the deal here, or if we haven't noticed, let's wake up and notice. Look, everything that can be lost will be lost. It's simple. How could we have missed it for so long? Let's grieve our losses fully like ripe human beings, but please, let's not be so shocked by them. Let's not act so betrayed as though life had broken our secret promise to us. Impermanence is life's only promise to us, and she keeps it with ruthless impeccability. To a child, she seems cruel, but she's only wild, and her compassion exquisitely precise, brilliantly penetrating, luminous with truth. She strips away the unreal to show us the real. This is the true ride. Let's give ourselves to it. Let's stop making deals for safe passage. There isn't one anyway, and the cost is too high. The true human adult gives everything for what cannot be lost. So let's dance the wild dance of no hope." So the first of these four recollections, I'm the nature to age, to die, to sicken, be separated from all that is dear to me, are kind of like the, maybe the harsh reality that is to be known and understood. And then the fifth recollection, the one about karma, is where we have some agency. The word karma was in use at the time of the Buddha, but he kind of redefined it to mean intentional actions of body, speech, and mind, that all actions have an effect. Words from the Dhammapada, this is Gill's translation. "All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow." The Buddha also described karma. He said, whatever a person keeps pursuing with their thinking and pondering, that becomes the inclination of their awareness. Whatever a person keeps thinking and pondering, that becomes the inclination of the awareness. And we see that, you know, we humans are capable of extraordinary feats in music, sports, dance, art, so many arenas, because whatever we practice, we get really good at it. And how we use our mind defines how we experience the mind, how we go through life, how we feel, how we act, how we treat others, how we meet challenges, whether we survive, just survive, or whether we thrive. How we use and train the mind constructs our default modes. Where do we go when we're under stress? Do we immediately go to fear or anger or worry? Or do we go to compassion, interest, faith? And this is why practice is so important. This time on retreat is so precious, because if the mind is getting good at however we use it, there's a way in which we're always practicing something. And if we're not intentional about cultivating beautiful qualities of mind, or a peaceful calm abiding, or any of the other innumerable wholesome states, then we just end up practicing ways of being that come from our family, from our communities, from random thoughts that emerge from the environment, from social media or whatever. And because we're neurologically wired to be attracted and captivated and interested in that which is stressful and dangerous, which is a positive attribute, and this probably kept us alive as a species, this like knowing where the dangers are and remembering them. But left to chance, without that intentional movement toward the wholesome, we tend to just be practiced being anxious and scattered and agitated. So another way to prevent the unwholesome, especially the unwholesome that arise from an action, like contemplating doing something and not sure what the results will that be, is to reflect on that action. This is what the Buddha taught his son Rahula, who was probably 7 or 8 at the time. He said, "What do you think, Rahula? What is the purpose of a mirror?" Rahula says, "It's for checking your reflection, sir." The Buddha said, "In that same way, deeds of body, speech, and mind should be done only after repeated checking. When you want to do an act, you should check on that same act. Does this act with the body that I want to do lead to hurting myself, hurting others, or hurting both? If not, then to the best of your ability, don't do that thing." And if so, then you can do, I think I said that backwards. If so, then don't do that thing. And if not, do that thing. And then he invited him to make that reflection for 3 times in advance. You can reflect, is this likely to lead to suffering or the ending of suffering while you're doing the action? This is where it gets tricky, because this requires that we're present and aware and checking in as we're acting, which can happen when mindfulness is strong. And if you, in the midst of acting, you discern that this is unskillful, then you can stop, change gears, try something else. And then the third, reflecting a third time when the action is done, to go back and look at the results of the action so we can learn and make connections, learn from our mistakes and learn from our successes. A related way of presenting is to start to pay attention to what triggers the unwholesome and avoid or minimize those triggers. So as we cultivate more and more mindfulness, when we notice that an unwholesome state is present, can we track back to where it began and avoid those triggers? You know, and sometimes it's quite obvious, like if you're an alcoholic, you know it's a good place, a good practice to avoid bars or places where people are drinking a lot. It's just sort of common sense. If you're caught in the hindrance of desire, obsessed by some desire, you can take a look at what stimulates that desire. Like some desires stimulate more desire, like a potato chip or a fancy catalog, browsing the web, especially social media. Some desire sometimes has this quality of camouflaging. It's like there's this hidden belief that if we get that thing, that somehow that will cure our suffering and that will be a lasting satisfaction. So in my example, I don't keep potato chips in the house. I immediately throw away the fancy catalogs that appear on my doorstep, and I've uninstalled social media apps from the phone. I've just eliminated those triggers so I don't have to go down that road. You can do this with people, you know, certain people that, you know, maybe you can, I should say, certain people you have to have relationships with it. And then you're back to, you know, how can I be with this difficult person with compassion and kindness? But, you know, we have some agency to choose our relationships, and we can avoid people who, and these mind states can be quite contagious. So if you're around people, you know, who are anxious, it makes you more anxious. When you're around people who are worried all the time, you tend to worry more. When you're around people that are peaceful, you tend to be more peaceful. I think our community of practitioners is such a resource. Another way of thinking about avoiding is, sometimes it's called guarding the sense doors. This is much of the ethos of retreat, turning inward, simplifying, not engaging with all the alluring things out in the world. And the reduction of what, you know, stimulus that we're taking in is also conducive to samadhi, the gathering of the mind. It's another great tool for preventing. You know, I really enjoy movies, especially action, adventure, superhero kinds of movies. But I really have to pay attention. You know, if I watch them too late, then I get just slightly agitated, like enough that the characters will show up in my dreams and I don't sleep that well. And it took me actually a while to track back and make that connection. I'm trying to sleep and I'm noticing this unwholesome state of agitation and irritation. And I could actually track it back to just a stimulating experience and then choose better. So now my rule is not after 8. Really, one of the through lines of Dharma practice is that when we pay attention to our experience, we can learn from that experience in the ways that support us. So this is called Autobiography in 5 Short Chapters. This might be familiar to some of you. Chapter 1, I walk down the street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes me forever to find a way out. Chapter 2, I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place, but it isn't my fault. It takes a long time to get out. Chapter 3, I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. I know where I am. It is my fault, and I get out immediately. Chapter 4, I walk down the same street. There's a deep hole in the sidewalk. I walk around it. And then chapter 5, I walk down another street. I think I'll just end there. I had another thing, but it's probably too long. So why don't we just sit together for a few minutes, and then I'll ring a bell and send us on our way. And so my encouragement to you is to continue the practice of preventing the arising of unwholesome states with the guarding of the senses that you've been doing, noble silence, turning off devices, keeping the attention close and inward. And cultivating samadhi, relaxing into the schedule, more continuity of practice, walking, sitting, places in between. Thank you so much for your attention. I have one announcement, and that is that at 6:30 there's an optional practice discussion meeting. So if you'd like some support, you have some questions about the practice, you're welcome to come. You're also welcome to come if you'd just like to listen. That's at 6:30, and the link for that is at the bottom of your schedule on the IRO page. And then we'll go about a half hour, maybe less, depending on what's up for folks. And when that's over, you can then go to the sit that will be in progress in the main hall. All right, thanks everybody. A wonderful practice, so let's see you soon.